The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. After a year of speculative polls and pundits who could say anything because it was all guessing, my, the 2016 campaign has, you might say, officially begun. A year ago, no one was saying that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders would be the easy winners of the New Hampshire primary, but they were. Senator Ted Cruz did not duplicate his Iowa result, finishing third, and Marco Rubio slipped way back in the pack, while Ohio Governor John Kasich, coming in a distant second, managed to beat out the rest of the governors in the field. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us live from New Hampshire. Todd, what do you make of these results?
John, an absolutely huge victory for Bernie Sanders. There's no doubt about it. There's going to be a huge question whether he can take this momentum into the South and into Nevada, where Hillary Clinton is going to be strong with union members and minority voters. Sanders hasn't faced them yet. On the Republican side, a huge win for Trump, 35%, more than doubling anyone else in the field. You said John Kasich was second, and he poured everything into New Hampshire, more than 100 town halls. It's hard to see what his appeal is beyond New Hampshire because he hasn't been anywhere except for New Hampshire. And let's not forget about Jeb Bush, Governor Jeb Bush of Florida, fourth place, but at least respectable, and thinks that he has at least a reason to continue now.
So those folks may move on. Younger voters, very important both in this contest and in the contests that are coming up. What do you think of the importance of young voters, Todd?
Well, John, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders trounced the competition with first-time voters. It was really amazing. Bernie Sanders grabbed more than 80% of voters between 18 and 29 years old. Now, Hillary Clinton herself acknowledged this. Last night, she told her supporters that she has a lot of work to do with young people. Well, I've been spending some time with first-time voters here, not all of them, 18, by the way, to see what's driving them to the polls.
Together, we have sent the message that will echo from Wall Street to Washington, from Maine to California.
That's Bernie Sanders reveling in his more than 20-point win over Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire last night. It may not seem like it at first, but in a lot of ways, it all goes back to here. This is the student center at New Hampshire Technical Institute. It's a community college in Concord. NHTI is just one of a large network of community colleges in New Hampshire, a network the candidates discovered in a big way over the last year. Cassidy Brennan is 20. She's an environmental student and active in the campus's voter registration drive.
Off the top of my head, I remember Lindsey Graham came at one point. I believe Martin O'Malley came. I know Hillary came at one point. That was a little bit bigger deal because her family's been in politics more, so people know the name.
Community colleges were all over the candidates' schedules running up to Tuesday. Campaigns have figured out that first-time voters are key to victory here, and that the crowd you can bring out to a community college rally isn't likely to be students from some other state. Chances are they vote close by, right here in New Hampshire.
Is that in your graveyard?
Yes.
Remove a card in your graveyard from the game.
Okay.
Go.
Over on one side of the room, about 10 students circle around a table for a game of Magic the Gathering. And for almost everyone here, business means Bernie Sanders. Here's Katrina Joseph. She's 21, and she's a first-time voter.
You gotta feel that burn, man. Voting is important because, if you don't vote, you're actually helping the people that you don't want in office. You also have to be mindful of the candidate that you pick, too.
I just don't really care.
Dude, if Trump wins,
it's all my country. If this goes wrong, I can just go home.
That last guy is Michael Pitt. He's 19 and a dual U.S.-British citizen. He could vote.
But I don't really follow politics enough to actually make an informed decision, and I'm too lazy to follow politics to make an informed decision, so I don't really vote.
Michael's not really interested, but in that respect, he was alone at that table. And there are fewer and fewer students like him.
That's according to Stu Wallace, a history instructor at NHTI, who teaches a course on New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation primary.
Students here are signing up right and left to vote because they are inspired. And even if a Bernie Sanders or any other candidate can't do all of the things they say they're going to do, so what? They're trying to do something. The Sanders effect is to get people in for the first time, to inspire them, and that is similar to the Obama effect.
Wallace thinks it's a myth that young students flock to Sanders just because of his promise of free public college tuition. He says they know they'll be out of school already, if and when that ever becomes a reality.
One of the things I say to students is, you're 18, you can vote. When I was 18, I couldn't vote, and I wound up going to war. So get out there and vote. I thought it being able to vote at 18 was great, but I was in Vietnam.
Of course, not all of New Hampshire's first-time voters were students. I found Megan Jansen at a protest of striking fast food workers calling for a $15 minimum wage. Megan has three kids and brings home about $500 per paycheck from her job at KFC.
I have never voted yet because it never affected me before. Up until now, like growing up, I was never told what the difference was between a Democrat and a Republican. And I still don't really know the difference, but I know that my vote will help the impact with everything, so I'm hoping for 15 an hour.
If Megan sounded like a Bernie Sanders vote, even that doesn't mean that all first-time voters fell on the Democratic side.
We are going to start winning again, and we're going to win so much, you are going to be so happy. We are going.
There's Donald Trump celebrating his huge Republican win here on Tuesday night. Trump events in New Hampshire weren't the college fests that Sanders rallies could be, but Trump still dominated the GOP field with people like Muriel LaBrie. She's a 51-year-old retired bartender who I ran into outside of Trump's victory rally last night and who had just voted for the very first time.
I've never, ever gotten into it as much as this until I completely fell in love with Reagan when it was too late. He was already in office.
So you never voted?
No. But he wasn't about the politics. He just went in, kicked ass, didn't, you know, care what people thought. People hated him, they loved him, but they respected him. And that's pretty much what Trump is. And that's, I have the chance now to make it up and vote.
And there's one more quadrennial ritual New Hampshire first-time voters now get to experience with everyone else: watching the campaigns and the media pack up and take off for Nevada and South Carolina. In Concord, New Hampshire, I'm Todd Zwillick for The Takeaway.
The young voter issues actually tell a story that matters a lot to the Republican Party in 2016 as well. If you add in first-time voters and undeclared independents, the Trump juggernaut begins to look like its own insurgency within the GOP. Alex Smith is national chairwoman of the College Republican National Committee, here to discuss the importance of young voters in 2016. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you so much for having me on, John.
It seems like the candidates in the New Hampshire primary were more responsible for bringing new people to the polls than the parties were, per se. What do you think the challenge is here, particularly for the GOP, in getting new voters and young voters to the polls?
Well, I think this shows a really promising sign for the GOP. I mean, we've always been a grassroots, bottom-up party, and we've always known that it's the caucus-goers and primary voters of our party that are going to choose our nominee. So the fact that we have such a diverse array of candidates that's drawing out new people from the electorate, I think, is a net positive for our party.
But it's Donald Trump that's drawing the new people out. It seems almost as though the vote for Trump can be seen as a rejection of the traditional GOP.
Well, I would say that it's the Republican Party that is big enough and strong enough to accommodate this kind of diversity of candidates. I think, by contrast, if you look at the Democrats and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, she has done everything she can to put her finger on the scale for Hillary Clinton. The Democratic Party has been the one that's tried to force choices upon their members, whereas the Republican Party has opened its arms wide open to, you know, these candidates out there that are coming from all kinds of different backgrounds.
Although, rather than get into a party versus party discussion, and the Democrats have their own problems, and that's really clear from New Hampshire, this seems to be a general rejection of traditional party organization and traditional party mechanisms for choosing candidates. You can accommodate Trump, certainly, if he says he's a Republican, but having to make him pledge that he won't be an independent voter doesn't give much of a sense that he's a terribly loyal Republican in the traditional GOP sense. You know what I mean?
Well, I would say that the jury's still out in terms of what traditional mechanisms are working and still viable in the 2016 elections and which are not. I think that we've had two very different contests over the last couple of weeks play out. We had the Iowa caucuses and last night the New Hampshire primaries. And in the caucuses, you saw very much that the traditional structure favored the candidate that worked the traditional game, which was Ted Cruz. I mean, he had a data game that was specifically designed around traditional caucus turnout models using demographic data and using new technology to drive out that turnout. Whereas in New Hampshire, perhaps the retail politics and the traditional mechanisms there were sort of upended by Donald Trump and his just absolutely unbelievable campaign where he was able to draw out supporters without having a more traditional ground game. So I think that we're still, I think it's too early to say whether or not traditional mechanisms have seen their last day.
Are you prepared to say today that you would be comfortable with Donald Trump as the nominee for the Republican Party?
Absolutely. You know, I think that the most important thing is having a Republican in the White House in 2016. You know, we've had 8 years of President Obama, and he's been a disaster for our country. And I think that voters are looking for change. They're looking for someone to turn that around. I think the most important thing for the party is beating that Democratic nominee come the fall. We have someone who's under an FBI investigation in Hillary Clinton. We have a socialist in Bernie Sanders. And so I can't think of a time where the stakes were higher. So, you know, I think the party is proudly going to get behind, you know, our nominee, whoever that might be. And I think at this point, it's still a jump ball in a lot of ways. But in our estimation, anything is preferable to the two choices that the Democrats have to offer.
Kasich suggests that a positive message that doesn't include the last 8 years were a complete disaster, as you just suggested, might be more appealing to the centrist sort of voter who is likely to be most decisive in November. What do you think about that?
He is absolutely right. In all of the research that we've done, particularly of young voters are looking for a problem solver. They're looking for someone who isn't afraid to take on the big challenges of today and isn't afraid to be who they say they are. And I think that that's where you're seeing candidates like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump being rewarded. And also Governor Kasich. I think that there's an authenticity about him that a lot of voters, particularly young voters, are finding appealing. The fact that he was able to bridge the partisan divide while he was in Congress, the fact that he was able to turn around the state of Ohio using bipartisan support within the state, that's all very appealing to younger voters especially. And why do younger voters matter the most in the 2016 elections? Because they decided the 2012 elections, and they're going to do it again in 2016.
Alex Smith, National Chairwoman of the College Republican National Committee. Thanks so much, Alex.
Thank you for having me on.
The heroin crisis in America dominated many of the town meetings in the lead up to the New Hampshire primary. A tidal wave of death was how one senator referred to it this week, affecting every part of the country. Yesterday, the director of National Drug Control Policy announced an increase of nearly $1.1 billion for prevention and treatment in combating the prescription opioid and heroin use epidemic. 23% of people who take prescription opioids, it's estimated, go on to an addiction that leads to heroin. Mark Kleiman is professor of public policy and director of the Crime Reduction and Justice Initiative at New York University's Marin Institute, as well as editor of the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis. Kleiman says balancing pain management and addiction is a huge medical challenge that money alone won't solve.
The notion that there's a solution sitting out there if we just had the resources for it, I think is probably not right. Let me give an example of the kind of things that I think we ought to be doing right now. There's a drug called LAM, which is a chemical relative of methadone, that was on the market for a few years as a opiate maintenance drug. And was taken off it because it couldn't penetrate the clinic system and because the methadone industry fought it very hard. And the manufacturer essentially took it off the market. We now understand what the side effect problem was that led to that, easily fixable. And it would be great if people didn't have to go to a methadone clinic every day to get a long-acting opiate substitute. But we have no mechanism for getting that drug back on the market. You'd have to wait for some manufacturer to decide, yes, it's worth the effort to get the regulatory approval and get it on the market. There's nobody in the government with the authority to say, look, we need this medicine on the market. We're going to do the work to get it through the FDA process. We're going to put it on the market. So part of what we're running into here is a drug approval and regulatory process that doesn't respond well to this kind of crisis.
Here's a comment from one of our listeners who just called us out of the blue and said, I've been on again, off again heroin addict, and I'm currently using but functioning, meaning that I have a full-time job, going to school, I really want to get clean, nobody really knows, and I just don't feel like I have the right resources to get the help that I'm looking for. Now, is she committing a crime? Is she in a public health problem? Is she having a behavioral disorder of some kind? Where does she fit in all this?
Well, whether she's committing a crime or not depends on the laws we pass. It's now my view that the laws forbidding people to have drugs, you know, for non-medical use that they're just going to use themselves are probably a bad idea. So I think we'd be better off with something more along the lines of the Portuguese system, where there's some coercive attention to people with drug problems, but not criminal treatment of mere possession. So that's merely a question of legal definition.
One of the ironies is, as well, regulatory issues and drug approval issues impede what might be a market force process to address this issue more quickly. Meanwhile, illegal heroin producers are taking advantage of the fact that opiates are gateway drugs, and they're producing heroin at cheaper costs with additives that enhance the effect and making it much more available to people who come off their prescription opiates and go immediately to heroin. They're seeing the market opportunity and moving very, very quickly.
And it's a huge policy headache. If you don't crack down on the pill mills, we're going to wind up with more people addicted to the prescription opiates. And when their habit gets out of their financial range, they're going to trade down to heroin. If we do crack down on the pill mills, the people who can't get the pills anymore will immediately go looking for a heroin dealer, and the heroin dealers will immediately come looking for them. So it's a kind of pay me now or pay me later situation. But the thing I would attack first is the Narcotic Addict Treatment Act, which restricts methadone and LAM, which is the relative of methadone, to the clinic system. Almost any other drug, you can get a prescription from your physician. So I think if we made the substitutes more available, we could probably make some progress on the issue and hope that over time people will learn about the dangers. I mean, an interesting thing about the current wave of opiate problems is that it almost doesn't exist in the areas that were heavy heroin areas 40 years ago.
Wow.
Because people there know about that stuff. So this is hitting primarily white, primarily suburban and rural communities very hard. And inner city black neighborhoods are largely unaffected by it. Well, there'll be some social learning, but it's a painful process.
Do you think that the United States is going through a period where a huge component of the population is experiencing what, say, Russia experienced in the 1980s, where the death rate actually increased and the population shrank because of an extraordinarily dim outlook on the future regarding almost everyone in Russia?
That's certainly the obvious comparison, and in particular in Russia, it was middle-aged men who died like flies. Numerically, the problem here is not nearly as bad. I mean, there you could sort of see it in the newspaper. Here you need statistical analysis for it. But yeah, I mean, that's the direction we're going in. That's something we should be deeply worried about. And I don't think it's unconnected with the fact that some of those people are voting for Donald Trump. The level of desperation, I think, has been underestimated.
Mark Kleiman is professor of public policy and director of the Crime Reduction and Justice Initiative at New York University's Marin Institute, as well as editor of the Journal of Drug Policy Analysis. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
The broad powers in the EPA's legal authority to regulate emissions from coal-fired power plants got trumped by an injunction from the U.S. Supreme Court this week. It's a setback for the president's plans to enact environmental policy without getting congressional approval. Challenges from 29 states and state agencies, along with corporations and industry groups, will still be considered by an appeals court before the case returns to the Supreme Court. Lee Patterson, reporter with Inside Energy, joins me now. Lee, what does this mean?
Well, hi, John. Thanks for having me. And John, there's really no other way to say it. This decision is a major blow to the Obama administration. I mean, essentially what happened is the Supreme Court has put on hold, in a 5-4 decision, the implementation of the Clean Power Plan, known as the CPP, until all legal challenges to it are resolved. So the rule is not dead, it's just on hold. And just as a little bit of a refresher of what we're talking about, the Clean Power Plan, of course, is the first ever federal rule to limit CO2 emissions from existing power plants. It's a key part of the president's climate change agenda. And the reason that the states involved in this litigation wanted to stay is really the heart is because the rule is forcing some very long-term decisions to be made, especially by utility companies, decisions mostly having to do with shutting down old, inefficient coal-fired power plants and replacing them with natural gas-fired power plants. And these are big, costly infrastructure investments. So the argument is that the states shouldn't have to be doing any of this until they know that there's something to actually comply with. And so the Supreme Court decision is a victory for those states and a really big deal for the Obama administration. You know, just as recently as August, the president referred to the rule as the single most important step America has ever taken in the fight against global climate change.
Well, he took that step to Paris and touted it as the reason why the U.S. would be a leader in the global initiative on climate change. But it got trumped by this passion from, here's an example, Travis Detais from the Wyoming Mining Association.
Well, you know, we're going to continue to mine coal. I mean, that's what we do. And I think with this rule, it shows that, you know, there's a lot of questions surrounding the administration's path in pursuing their climate change agenda, and they remain to be answered. And in the meantime, here in Wyoming, we're gonna continue to mine coal and provide for the nation's electricity.
And of course, Wyoming is a big coal mining state. Is the president wrong in assuming that the EPA's enabling legislation has the broad powers that he thinks it has to regulate the carbon?
Well, I mean, that's really the central question, and that gets at the heart of the Supreme Court's decision yesterday. Those legal challenges to the Clean Power Plan are basically that the federal government, it's overreach, and that the federal government does not have the authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate CO2 emissions from existing power plants. The outcome is very much up in the air. As I said before, the rule is on hold, but it is not dead. And, you know, we'll see how this plays out over the next couple of months. But the really important point to remember here is that despite legal challenges and some very, very strong rhetoric on both sides for and against the Clean Power Plan, most states on a practical level are already working on how to comply by drafting an implementation plan, because what it comes down to is that despite yesterday's decision, states just can't afford not to plan ahead in case the Supreme Court doesn't overturn the rule. And of course, there's that chance.
Lee Patterson is a reporter with Inside Energy. She spoke to us from Wyoming. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Perhaps the boldest initiative from the $4 trillion 2017 White House budget released on Tuesday is a proposal that includes $19 billion for cybersecurity funding. That's a third more than last year's budget. The president's Cybersecurity National Action Plan includes money to overhaul the federal computer systems and the development of a closer working relationship with the private sector. Silicon Valley meets federal technology from another century. Is this a milestone in the quest to modernize, or is the U.S. already so far behind that throwing money at the problem will accomplish little at this point? Newell O'Connor is the former chief privacy officer for the Department of Homeland Security and is currently president and CEO of the Center for Democracy and Technology. It's a nonprofit focused on advocating a free and open internet. Newell, I gather this isn't a matter of just getting some new devices at the federal level to modernize the system here.
That's absolutely right, John. It's a milestone of sorts in a long history of movement towards recognizing both cybersecurity and individual privacy as very compelling public policy and public good issues for the federal government. So it is an important day, and certainly money does help. A couple of other things in the president's announcement: the creation of a privacy council of leaders within the government, a cybersecurity commission of external experts to bring in expertise to the Department of Commerce and across the federal agencies. So very, very important work. And it does reflect that cybersecurity is one of the compelling public policy issues of the next century.
It also reflects that there appears to be a conflict between cybersecurity and privacy, and that there is a lot of resolution to do there, wouldn't you say?
So many people have said for decades now that privacy and security are at odds. I've always said they are two sides of the same coin. You need to have good cybersecurity around data and systems to protect individual privacy, and that privacy is a fundamental interest of our citizens and needs to be protected and respected by folks working in security as part of their goal. So I actually think they can be complementary, but you are right that some of the announcements do strike fear in the hearts of people who worry about individual liberty and privacy and the rights of our citizens in the online, in the completely interconnected world. The idea of more information sharing with the private sector, important when we're talking about systemic threats. In the last decades, we've seen one after another major data breach in the private sector, leading right up to the Sony hack, which was very, you know, significant actually in scope and scale and impact. And so companies that do important and critical infrastructure work, like run power plants and run infrastructure like railroads, definitely need to be sharing threat issues. But what we worry about, obviously, is the constant sharing of personal information about our citizens in a permanent way with federal government. We'd like to see a very bright line between those data sets in the private sector and the public sector.
On the security question, if the agencies that you're talking about, electric power plant, the grid, even the federal government, is playing catch up on the latest technology, upgrading, you know, from laptops to tablets, for instance, something as rudimentary as that. Can you really be strategic about a security system in the cyber realm? Don't you have to design from the most advanced possible technology to stay ahead of the hackers?
Well, you know, it is always a cat and mouse game on both sides of the public and private divide. Having worked in both cybersecurity and privacy in the private sector and in the public sector, I'd say that the public sector has more catching up to do, as is seen by the most recent OPM breach, where the files of many senior government officials and many government officials across the country, including probably my own, were compromised. And I worry, frankly, more about that side of the house. And so money towards those systems and money towards internal systems for the federal government to improve and really come out of the 1960s, frankly, in some cases, is essential. So, and I think, again, information sharing about best practices, you know, would be a good thing. Information sharing about our citizens, we have real concerns about.
If some agencies are still in the 60s, you're only as vulnerable as the worst agency in the federal government. You really raise a frightening point, actually, on cybersecurity. Nuala, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Nuala O'Connor is former chief privacy officer for the Department of Homeland Security 2003 to 2005. One 100 years ago, President Woodrow Wilson signed into law a bill creating the National Park Service. And so the great American mission to curate its own natural beauty and historical legacy for future generations began. The parks now number nearly 60, from well-known Acadia National Park in Maine and Yosemite in California, and less well-known parks like the Dry Tortugas National Park in Key West, Florida.
Not so long ago, the early pioneers had no idea what lay beyond the frontier. Imagine an entire continent of unmapped wilderness and a people who believed that the greatest natural wonders belong to no one. They belong to all.
That's Robert Redford narrating the documentary film National Parks Adventure. The film tries to put viewers inside each of 30 national parks in a virtual pilgrimage told through the stories of Conrad Anker, a mountaineer who takes a national parks road trip followed by the ambitious film's IMAX-equipped director, Greg McGillivray.
That was our first problem. How do you tell the story in 40 minutes in an IMAX film? So I tell two stories, one of Conrad and his son and a family friend as they go on a road trip from site to site, various places in the West, national park locations where they can climb. But then at the same time, we tell the story of the origins of the National Park Service and the story of John Muir and Teddy Roosevelt spending three nights together in Yosemite back in 1903, which were pivotal moments for the conservation movement. In fact, conservationists call it the three most important days in the history of conservation.
When did you first understand that a trip across the country, a trip to some of these locations was a kind of a pilgrimage that really was a part of growing up?
I was introduced to the parks by my parents at a young age, and that's what we did. We would go into the backcountry of the Sierras with a couple mules and a horse and go backpacking every summer. So that was what our family did, and it was a natural progression to go from that. And then seeing as that we have all these wonderful parks and what they bring to people, that sense of relaxation, rejuvenation, this seems like the sensible place to go for a holiday.
Based on your upbringing, what visuals should every American have of that natural beauty? I mean, I suspect living down the road from Yosemite, El Capitan is absolutely one of the things that every American should see. But what other visuals do you think are really a part of the American heritage?
Denali in Alaska, the highest point in North America, is one. The Grand Canyon, Everglades, the Great Smoky Mountains in Appalachia. All these places have something unique and something that is part of the American heritage.
But I think it's also interesting that the Park Service, they celebrate America's deficiencies, too, and some of its problems. Battlefields are represented. The camp for Japanese Americans during World War II is set aside as a national park site. And so it's just not the beautiful places. It's historical places, the places that mean something to us as a country. And as people have said, this is a real kind of representation of our democracy, because these things belong to us. They don't belong to the king and queen. They don't belong to the aristocracy or the wealthy. They belong to each one of us.
How much do you typically pack when you head into the wilderness for a few days? How many pounds?
Well, it depends on – I'm a climber, which I love to go to. And,
right.
And so sometimes I'll go really lightweight and purposely take a minimal amount of gear and food just to – have hardship and have suffering.
And you're paired up with Mr. IMAX over here, right? Who's basically bringing a container.
That's true.
Not
easy.
What is the challenge of getting an IMAX into Bryce Canyon?
Well, you need to have a film crew that is big and beefy and strong, and IMAX is the highest quality. And if you then take this gigantic camera to places like Niagara and elsewhere that have human impact, you can convey to the public that, wow, these places are amazing, they're worth protecting, and, gee, is there a way to get it back to the way it was 50 years ago?
When I see people in the national parks, I could be a critic and say, well, they're not getting out of their cars, they're not taking a hike, they're going in there and they're buying an ice cream cone and then they're leaving and they're sort of ticking the box. But that's better than not getting there. So there's a good start on that. And the other part of it is that in creating this film, we're bringing attention to the parks. And will a family, after watching the movie, decide to take a holiday to a national park? We hope so. Because when you go to a park, Greg and I firmly believe that it's a good, healthy thing to do for a family. You communicate with your children. You get to see nature. You don't have a television screen going. You don't have a computer game going. You get out there and you hike and you talk. I mean, you get blisters and you get thirsty and you challenge yourself. And those are good attributes to share with your family. And the national parks is the perfect setting for that.
Should there be Wi-Fi, free federal Wi-Fi and all?
You should answer that one.
I say no. Where I live in Montana, there's a place that I can go that I know I get cell reception and my smartphone will work. So I can work when I'm up there. But then there's other canyons where I go, okay, nothing's working up here. I'm off the grid. And that would be, that's a good thing. And when you're out with your kids, then you have to put them away.
You know, I feel the same way. And I think it's so critical for us to get back to the one-on-one experience and just having the quiet of the human experience with one another and with nature is just so key.
I'm particularly moved by this ritual of Black Friday that, you know, we're all told we have to go shop on Black Friday. The parks make this suggestion, go to the parks for free on Black Friday after Thanksgiving. And it's been wildly successful. Why do you think?
People have had enough. Mm. We all consume. We need to consume. That's human existence. We need to make sure that we have breakfast and dinner, and we need to be clothing and shelter. But anytime you're away from the human construct, where you have right angles, glass, concrete, plastic, all these things, and you're in the random chaos of nature, you come back rejuvenated and happy.
Any thoughts on Mount Rushmore? Was it a mistake?
It's what happened at the time. Would we do it in this day and age? Probably not. We wouldn't. We would make something like the monument or memorial, but we wouldn't carve up a mountain into a statue.
Greg and Conrad, thank you so much.
Why, thank you.
Well, thank you, too.
Greg McGillivray directed the film National Parks Adventure, featuring Conrad Anker, a mountaineer and National Parks ambassador. The film opens this Friday in IMAX theaters across the country. To find out where to see it in your neighborhood, go to thetakeaway.org. Hey, take this with you today. The signs of Lent for millions of Christians on this Ash Wednesday recall the story of how a food entrepreneur named Lou Gorin introduced the famous Filet-O-Fish sandwich at one of his Ohio McDonald's franchises on Good Friday in 1962, so his mostly Catholic clientele could get a fast food option and stay meatless. 3 years later, the Filet-O-Fish went national. 300 million are consumed every year, 23% of them during Lent. Take a look at the market these days. Maybe McDonald's needs to say some prayers about its shrinking revenues or find another pious Lou Gorin. Halal happy meal, perhaps? That's all for today, but tell us a story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.